You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
There's nothing like a shaggy dog, baby. They're shagadelic. And this is the place to find out how to achieve harmony in the household with your pets. Yeah, peace, harmony, pet power. Holy shih tzu, baby. You'll learn how to keep your pets from chewing your shoes or eating your cat. It's all about relationships, baby. You and your pet... Pet! So tune in, turn on, and get ready for the positively grooviest pet podcast on the planet. Ooh, that's a lot of peas, baby, isn't it?
What's this show called?
Oh, Behave!
No, really. What's this show called?
Oh, Behave! With your shagadelic host, Arden Moore. What's happening, Arden? Yeah, baby, yeah, yeah. Tell us.
Welcome to the Oh, Behave show on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Arden Moore. I thank you all for joining us today. We're going to be discussing domestication of dogs with a very, very special guest. She is Alice Moon Finelli. She has a PhD. She is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Clinical Sciences at Tufts University in their School of Veterinary Medicine. I want everyone to please give tons of tail wags and plenty of purrs to Dr. Alice Moon Finelli. Hey, Alice, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Arden.
I appreciate that. What we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about dogs, and we have one of the top experts probably on the planet that can help us separate fact from fiction. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk to Alice about that, but we're going to be right back and take a commercial break.
Would you like to go out? Well, actually, I was talking to your owner. I meant on a date, baby. Yeah, you and me. Oh, Behave! We'll be right back after these groovy, shagadelic messages. Oh, yeah.
Passengers, please fasten your seatbelts, put your seat bags and sleeping pets in their full upright position, and prepare for takeoff.
Pet Life Radio presents Travel Tales, the show where you'll get great travel ideas on perfect places for you and your pet. From Paris to paradise, south of the border to the South Seas, Travel Tales will give you cool tips on fun vacation destinations to travel with your pet, pet-friendly hotels, and advice on how to travel safely and happily with your furry best friends. So, get ready to pack the bags and the bones with your Travel Tales hosts, Susan Sims and Nicholas Veslowski, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
We're switched back on, baby. Yeah. So let's talk pets with our smashing host, pet edutainer, Arden Moore, and the groovy show that's cool, baby. Really shagadelic. Oh, Behave.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Oh, Behave show on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Arden Moore. As mentioned, we have a great guest, Dr. Alice Moon Finelli. She is a clinical assistant professor at the Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine in Tufts University. And what I'd like to talk to you about today, Alice, is about the dog, or as you probably call it, the Canis lupus familiaris. Is that right? Did I say it right?
That's the way it sounds now with all the molecular genetic data that's coming in.
Yeah,
but it's always subject to change as we find more information.
Well, talk a little bit about, first of all, what got you started in trying to track down the history of dogs, if you will. What got you? Because you've got a lot of nice degrees in ethology and animal behavior genetics. You're someone, if I'm on a TV show, I'll probably have you as my lifeline because you've got a lot of neurons firing in your brain.
Well, I started out, I grew up with an interest in dogs because my mother bred and showed German Shepherds, so I grew up in a show dog kennel.
Okay.
And then I went to the University of Connecticut and studied wolf social behavior. And from there, decided that watching wolves sleep for hours on end in their enclosure was not really quite stimulating enough for me because they sleep a lot more than they behave except during the breeding season. So I began studying coyote-beagle hybrid crosses and their threat behavior, which got me interested in aggression, and the differences between domestic dogs and wild canids and how that manifests when you mix the genetics between the two.
When you say that, and, if I may ask, I mean, you're here you are, you're a student at Connecticut, and you're checking out these wolves sleeping and occasionally getting rowdy-towdy. But what led you to this whole notion of the coyote-beagle crosses? That's kind of fascinating.
Well, that's something that my advisor had an interest in. Coyotes, when they threaten like a cat with a wide-open mouth gape threat, and they make a hissing vocalization, and they arch the back similar to a cat.
Okay.
And, of course, you never see that in domestic dogs. So being interested in behavior genetics, we decided to make that cross and study the inheritance of that and any environmental and developmental factors that would influence the expression of that behavior in the various generations of hybrids.
Okay. And, you know, when people think of a beagle, the first thing they think of, oh, have nose, will travel. And then the coyote, people get a little bit nervous because they seem to be quite the animal that can survive and on their wiles. I mean, it seems like an interesting combination.
Well, geneticists always like to cross extremes because that's the way you get the most information.
Oh, okay.
And in a kennel, you know, if we crossed a coyote, say, to a husky, we wouldn't have all the differences in the physical characteristics that would be inherited, be able to study that. Also, in terms of just the laboratory environment, beagles are nice because they're short-coated, they're friendly, so they offset a lot of the other aspects of having coyotes in captivity that might be a little more difficult. Plus, we had access to John Paul Scott's Bar Harbor beagles, so we knew quite a bit about their genetic legacy.
Yeah, you'd like to do your research keeping all fingers intact, right?
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the hardest part was getting the male beagle to breed the female coyote because his hind legs would be off the ground, and that was a bit entertaining.
I could just see the male beagle saying, please, please, let's just work this through. I mean you no harm. I want to be the father of your children. Now, did you actually raise some coyote beagle crosses, or did you have some that you kind of shepherd along?
I did at the university, and then I got wildlife permits to raise two of them at home, yes.
Oh, my gosh. Now, folks, we're listening to Dr. Alice Moonfinelli. She is a top animal behaviorist at the Cummings School at Tufts University. And I'm just curious because I have met you and John, your great guy husband, and I can just see that you have a wonderful marriage. And I can just see, you know, folks sometimes wonder how it's going to work when you have a dog in the mix. But these weren't just any other dogs. So what was it that you had to talk to John about to say, hey, honey, there's this kind of an unusual dog I'm bringing home? How did that work out?
Well, actually, the dog came first. I had Henry VIII before John came on the scene, and the coy dogs were rather spooky of people that they didn't know. And I guess John found Henry and myself fascinating enough that he was willing to sit on the floor in the living room and howl for about a month before Henry would approach him.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they were very bonded.
Is that how he started his band?
If he'll sit on the floor and howl with my dog to make friends with my dog for me, this is the guy to marry. And from
Absolutely.
There, I think he just got kind of hooked, and every time I'd talk about bringing home another wild dog, he was into it, and he's as fascinated with it as I am.
Well, that's great. And folks, her husband, John, is a great singer in a band, so I think maybe he got his vocals practiced by that howling, don't you think?
Maybe. I haven't gotten John and Pan to do a duet yet, but that's in the making.
That's the other thing. Now, she's gone from coy dogs, the combination of coyotes and beagles, and she has a very rare breed of dog. He's this great dog named Pan. He's a New Guinea singing dog, and for some of our listeners that have no clue what that means, describe Pan, both physically and some of his personality traits.
All right. First of all, the New Guinea singing dogs are listed with the United Kennel Club as a sighthound breed, but in fact, those of us that are working with the Conservation Society are working very hard to try and reenact their Canis halstrami taxonomic status, indicating that they are a separate subspecies of the canis. They're wild dogs from New Guinea that live up in the highlands. They are not scavengers that come down to the town. They aren't like the town dogs. In fact, nobody really sees them. Some of the natives in New Guinea do hear them, but say that they really don't see them very much. So they may have been domesticated at some time, but we're figuring at this point, looking at their DNA, they have not been in human contact for at least the last 6,000 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And the interesting thing about that is that they are so gentle and kind with people. They're highly predatory. They're probably the most skilled canine predator I've ever seen in my life. But with people, they tend to be very gentle. And it's almost like that Darwin-Galapagos effect, where when it went to the Galapagos Islands, none of the animals were afraid of people because they'd never known any harm. And the New Guinea singing dogs live so far up in the highland that they don't come into contact with people, and they are the major predator in that area, to the best of our knowledge. So they have no reason to fear people.
Interesting. Now, how did you get Pan and then to come to Connecticut and live with you and John?
I had been in contact with Jan Kohler-Matznick at the New Guinea Singing Dog Conservation Society, and she had contacted me to ask if she sent me some DVDs of New Guinea singing dog behavior, if I would look at them and say whether or not I'd ever seen any of the wolves or coyotes or domestic dogs that I had for years engage in some of these unique behaviors of the New Guinea singing dogs exhibit. And I agreed happily to do that. And when my last coyote beagle hybrid, Moses, died when he was 16, she just happened to have a litter of singing dogs on the ground and assured me that she could fly me one from Oregon and it would be fine. And I fell for it, and I'm ever so grateful I did. He's quite fascinating.
Now, how old is Pan?
He'll be 5 in November.
Okay. And I have met Pan, listeners, and this dog is great. When the dog greets you, he really wants to sniff your ears and around your head. And Alice has helped me realize that's the way he does it. And as long as you're accepting of it, I think we got along quite well, don't you think?
Absolutely. He adores you.
I love Pan. He's sweet. And anybody on the, we're going to hopefully use that photo of you holding Pan in your arms on this site when your show airs, so everybody can check out the adorable Pan. But I got to hear him sing. How would you describe that? It's just almost operatic.
The vocalizations vary quite a bit. I mean, sometimes he sounds like a wolf. Sometimes he sounds like a humpback whale. Sometimes I think I have a bird in my house. Their voices are very, very flexible.
And have you figured out the tones and the inflections mean certain things?
Oh, absolutely. He stares directly in your eyes, and if he's doing a little chirp, that means I want this, or he just has all kinds of, he's just always talking, but not in the sense, like with domestic dogs, somehow in the process of domestication, partly for working ability, like with the hounds, we've selected for increased vocalization, where they just go on and on and on, help, I'm barking and howling and I can't shut up.
Right.
You never see that in the wild canids. And even though the singing dogs are very vocal, every vocalization has a purpose and it has a meaning. And if they're not the kind of dog that the average person can live with, so I don't want people to go to the website and see how cute he is and say, oh, everybody wants him, you know? Small size, short coat, looks great. They are difficult to deal with because they are so supremely intelligent, very sensitive to what they're saying to you, because they're talking to you all the time. It's almost like living with a chimp.
Oh,
probably
wow.
Not quite as bad, but it's close. Not for the average person.
No, that's very good that you stress that, because sometimes people get hooked on looks and it's a bad match and it's just a recipe for disaster for everyone, the dog and the people.
Absolutely.
Folks, we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to the OBehave Show on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Arden Moore, and we'll be back right after these messages.
Would you like to go out?
Well, actually, I was talking to your owner. I meant on a date, baby. Yeah, you and me.
Oh, behave! We'll be right back after these groovy, shagadelic messages. Oh, yeah.
School's in session on Pet Life Radio with Teacher's Pet. Learn how to communicate with your pet, train your pet, and see the world from your pet's point of view. You may even learn a few tricks yourself. Teacher's Pet with pet expert and author Sarah Wilson. Only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
We're switched back on, baby. Yeah, so let's talk pets with our smashing host, pet edutainer Arden Moore, and the groovy show that's cool, baby. Really shagadelic. Oh, behave!
Welcome back. You are listening to the O Behave Show on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Arden Moore, and we are speaking with Dr. Alice Moon Finelli. She is a clinical assistant professor at the Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University. That's a mouthful, but we have more mouthfuls to feed you. She has a PhD in biobehavioral sciences, specializing in ethology and animal behavior genetics. Wow. And she's a pretty cool person, too. She knows dogs. She knows cats. She works at the Animal Behavior Clinic at Tufts University. She handles people's calls and questions about things going on with their cats and dogs and in their household all over the globe. In fact, I guess you even got a call as far away as Japan.
Yes, I have.
Okay. How long have you been at Tufts now?
It'll be 14 years in March.
Okay, so you have seen every day dogs and cats and people coming in with behavior issues. And I think there's some things, the reason I have you on is because I want you to help the folks understand, separate fact from fiction. When people talk about the domestication of dogs, it must tear your hair out when you hear some things that just aren't right. So I was hoping you could maybe address three or four points to set the record straight. Just give us a little background about the domestication of dogs. What's really the truth and what is something that's been a myth?
Well, with our domestic dogs, they've been selected for, originally they were selected for various traits to help man.
Okay.
And in that sense, certain aspects of their natural behavior have been exaggerated, such as predatory behavior in some of the terriers. They're
okay.
Far more predatory than the wolves or coyotes or seeing dogs. I mean, they are obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
Territorial behavior has been enhanced in some breeds for guarding behavior.
Is that like the Rottweilers or who?
Rottweilers, some of the Mastiffs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So we tinkered genetically in the past with their behavior to have them serve a purpose for us. And then in the Victorian age, everyone started selecting for appearance.
Okay.
And so the behavior has no longer been selected for, but you've got this cluster of genes for enhanced aspects of normal behavior in a particular breed. But when you no longer select for it, it can kind of go haywire. For example, the Dobermans were selected for going to war and, you know, being fairly protective and aggressive. And the breeders ran into a problem where the Dobies became sharp shy, shall we say, and there was a little bit too much aggression. So then they began to select away from that, finally realizing that, you know, they needed to pay attention to behavior. They couldn't even take the dog into the confirmation ring. And now what they've created are Dobermans that are still highly intelligent, but a bit less sharp shy for the most part, and I'm speaking in generalities.
Right.
But they've increased their anxiety levels since they've gone away from the aggression. So now you've got these Dobies that are sucking on blankets. They couldn't go to war without their woolly.
Oh my gosh.
So it's very important in terms of when you're labeling breeds, like this breed is aggressive and that breed is aggressive, and you're getting off onto your breed bands. You have to think in terms of what they were originally selected for and how that's lapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And what the genetics tell you, and whether or not these dogs are really genetically dangerous. And I mean, I don't believe that they are, and I don't believe that those situations can't be turned around. That's one of my things. I don't like the breed bans. I don't like the doggy races stuff, because when you stop selecting for behavior, you get extremes and whatever you've originally selected for. So it's just a matter of breeding away from that again.
Well, I know that at Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine, one of the things that you're involved with is every year or every other year, you have a major conference on genetics and breeding, and you bring both the veterinary geneticist in with reputable and responsible breeders. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And
there's
I
more
think
that we can educate them.
Collaboration.
And a lot of people, behavior genetics is rather new to people, because people have been so obsessed with physical characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a bit of stigma associated with behavior genetics. I mean, that went back to Nazi Germany, for one thing.
Right.
And it carries through with the dogs. People don't like to think about behavior having a genetic aspect, meaning that thinking that, well, if it's genetic, you can't change that. You know, if if someone says, oh, I have heart disease in my family, nobody blinks an eye. But if someone says, well, schizophrenia runs in my family, all of a sudden you're a bit shunned. And it's the same thing like with the tail chasing, the compulsive tail chasing and the bull terriers that I study. Breeders don't want to mess up to that. They'll talk about the kidney disease.
But do you think having conferences like you are is starting to kind of open up the door and stop this feeling of, oh my gosh, I can't really talk about it? It's almost like people years ago would never say menopause. They never even talk about getting divorced.
Absolutely.
And now there's songs and shows and everything about those fun topics. So
yeah, we're doing our best to present an open forum where more and more people can feel comfortable, and as they go back to their breed clubs and talk about what they learn each year, the conference grows larger. So it's you know, education is a slow process, but it's one that needs to be done.
Another aspect about domestication, I thought maybe you could clear the air, if you would, is people say that alpha dogs, and you know, you always hear about, oh, you know, you got to act like an alpha dog to your dog.
Please.
Does that put your hackles up? Can you tell me a little bit about that and help our listeners, folks? We're listening to Dr. Alice Moon Finelli. She is at Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine. She knows dogs. She knows how they were domesticated. This lady is great, and I'm just really honored that she's on the show. So, Alice, talk a little bit about that term that people use very loosely, alpha. Alpha dog.
Alpha and dominance have been so misunderstood, it's phenomenal. And again, that all started really back during World War II as well, was when that concept got a bit tweaked.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes across species. I mean, it's the same thing even with horses and dogs. People always have to dominate. They have to control, and they don't think at all about how an animal learns. They recognize that an animal has emotions, and they totally misconstrue the concept of dominance. Having watched wolves when they weren't sleeping and they were up doing things, and we had a family pack. It wasn't a pack where we just threw a bunch of wolves together, which is what a lot of the researchers at the time had done, and you get more aggression in that situation. But ours was an actual family pack. You never saw the alphas, which were the mother and father, showing much aggression to anybody. Everything was communicated. It's much like parenting. They just were good leaders. They had mm-hmm. good rules. They communicated through their body language. And this whole concept of owners having to alpha roll their dog, I've never seen an alpha wolf actually really alpha roll another wolf. It's the submissive animal that comes out up and throws himself down, him or herself, down at the feet of the dominant animal.
It's sort of like the people in the old days that would kneel for the queen. It's show of respect,
exactly.
Isn't it? Okay.
Exactly. When you get into what people are thinking, doing alpha rolls and stare downs and scruff grasping, when you have that occurring between two dogs or two wolves, that's aggression. That's not dominance. They are
Good
in an aggressive state where they're going to try and establish who's going to be the top dog. So when owners start, first of all, owners make terrible dogs, and the dogs know it. It's just you got to get the owners to realize they make terrible dogs. It would be far better if humans acted like humans and the dogs acted like dogs. I mean, we've domestically gone through domestication processes with them to select them to live with us, and so they're, you know, the dogs are fairly neotenous, and there's all these new studies out suggesting that they've, you know, learned to sort of evolved along with humans and learned to live with us. So why treat them like a wolf? They haven't been a wolf for thousands of years.
They're completely
different animals than the wolf,
though
they retain some of the social behaviors and postures.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're grasping the dog and you're staring at it and you're rolling it over and holding it upside down, you are being aggressive to your dog, and aggression begets aggression. So when you start engaging in these techniques because you saw something on television and it looked like it went really well in a three-minute clip, and you try this at home, and your dog bites you, you deserve it. You shouldn't believe everything you see on TV or you read on the internet. Common sense has to be involved.
I think the other thing that's very important here, this point, is that, you know, it is not, there are ways to be a leader with your dog.
Exactly.
Where you're clear and consistent, and this bullying of the dog, it's going to backfire. And you know what I'm sad about is that not only is the person injured, but doesn't it take an awful lot for a dog to bite a person, and then the effects of that dog, and that dog may end up being at a shelter or worse, you know?
Most dogs that bite have been taught to bite by people. And the way people teach dogs to bite is people are so egocentric, and so unsubtle in their communicating skills and their understanding of body language that they don't see what the dog is trying to tell them from the get-go. Maybe the body stiffening, the looking away, averting the gaze, any lip licking, yawning, all indicates an animal is sort of anxious. It's a bit of a displacement behavior, like, could you just back off from me?
Right.
But people don't see that, and they've got this primate urge to come and grab this dog around the neck and stomp it on top of the head and do the hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo thing. And for dogs, that's a challenge. Anything up and over the head, up and around the neck, direct close eye contact is a challenge. Patricia McConnell wrote about it. This was actually her observation. She wrote about it in I believe it's her book, Who's at the Other End of the Leash. She was a primatologist and now works with dogs. And it's just fabulous observation because it explains why you can't people to stop staring dogs closely into their eyes and patting them on top of the head. And what happens is when people don't pay any attention, the dog sort of backs off and looks away. It's doing its best to say, but dog body language is very subtle. You know, it's doing its best to say, please back off, this is very rude. And the people keep coming forward, and the dog learns to snarl. And people will say, but all dogs like me, and love will conquer all. And then the dog growls, oh, but all dogs love me, and love will conquer all. And they keep cornering and cornering and cornering the dog. Finally, the dog bites. And over time, with very few repetitions, they learn to dispense with all the preliminary body language signals and just go straight for the bite.
Wow.
There are no dogs that I have ever encountered that weren't, like, just completely wired wrong, that bite right from the get-go. They are taught that because people don't pay attention to what the dog is telling them.
Yeah, what kind of advice could you give people when their dog, quote-unquote, needs to have a little good doggy parenting done? I know we have a few minutes left, so if you could talk a little bit about maybe the Nothing in Life is Free program, or just how to be more clear and consistent with being sort of the benevolent leader.
Right. The animal who's in charge of the group, the animal who's the leader, is the one who has priority access to all resources.
Okay.
And with the Nothing in Life is Free program, what we ask owners to do is to request that their dog follow a command, said only once. The dog should respond within 3 seconds. This is assuming the dog really knows this command. Mm-hmm. In order to receive any resource it needs or wants, the only thing it gets for free are water and air. This includes attention from the owners, which is the hardest thing for owners to do, not just to lavish praise on their dog.
And that's my lavish dog, Chipper, because there's a delivery person that she loves. Go ahead.
It establishes leadership in the sense that the dog has to learn to say please. But also what happens is, if the owners are working with the dog throughout the day, oh, there goes Pan.
Oh, listen, guys. Listen, Pan is howling. Wow.
I think that means what he's saying to me is, the show is up. Where's my watch?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we have about a minute left, so let's go ahead and...
Many owners don't communicate with their dogs. They take them to obedience class, and then they never use those commands at home. So by asking them to follow a command, they're actually increasing their communication. The dog is focusing on them more, listening.
Good.
Oh, please, Pan.
Listen to him. Folks, we are very fortunate to hear Pan.
He's done. I'm allowed
like
to talk on the phone for
much.
Half an hour. But that's a far better way to be a leader with your dog, to enhance your communication, to get the dog mentally stimulated during the day, learning new tricks. You don't want to stick with just obedience commands, because then you feel like a general, and you don't want to interact with your dog like that.
No.
So you'd like to teach your dog lots of tricks and various commands, so that you have all kinds of different things that you can ask them to do. And tricks are very good, because we like seeing our dogs do cool tricks. So you're more apt to follow along with the Nothing in Life is Free program if you've got something you can ask them to do.
Well, folks, we're listening
for example,
to Dr. Alice Moon-Finelli, and she is an animal behaviorist at Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine. We can go to the tufts.edu site, right, Alice, if people want to learn a little bit more about you? And do you want to talk about the Animal Behavior Clinic, how people can get in touch if they want to contact you?
They can contact us. Our information is on our website. We do see in-clinic appointments, and I operate a remote consultation service called PetFacts, where if you don't live close enough to come into the clinic, you can fill out one of our standardized behavior questionnaires, fax that back to us. I will review it and determine what sort of behavior modification programs you might need to improve your dog's behavior or your cat's behavior, for that matter, or your horse's behavior, too.
Okay.
And we send it back to you, and then you get 6 months follow-up included in the price of the initial consult.
So if they go to tufts.edu, T-U-F-T-S.edu, then they can go to the vet school and get on to finding about the animal behavior clinic information?
Yeah, right on the home page of the veterinary school's home page, there's a, under hospitals, I believe, there's the behavior clinic, and you go straight into there and then look for either in-clinic appointments or pet facts.
Well, I appreciate that. Alice, we're speaking with Alice Moon Finelli. Thank you very much for being a guest on the show. It's
You're
been
very
a pleasure.
Welcome, Arden.
You always fascinate me and teach me new things, and I'm just tickled that Pan decided to do a little backup vocals in the background, the New Guinea dog, singing dog. We want to let you know that if you'd like to know any more information about today's show or get a transcript of this show or any other show on Pet Life Radio Network, just go to PetLifeRadio.com and click on the Oh Behave Show. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, I welcome them. You can email me at arden@petliferadio.com. So until next time, this is your host, Arden Moore, and I have just two words for all of you 2-, 3-, and 4-leggers out there. Oh, behave!
There's nothing like a shaggy dog, baby. They're shagadelic. And this is the place to find out how to have harmony in the household with your pets. Oh, yeah. So stop by our pad every week and get switched on, baby. Switched on to the show that's all about attitude. Oh, behave. With your groovy host, pet edutainer Arden Moore. Yeah, baby, yeah. Every week on demand on PetLifeRadio.com.